Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim. Is it FX?
I'm Aaron.
Am I?
FX on Hulu.
Okay.
If you want to cover all of our bases.
That's where I watched it. I know you can watch it live on FX at 9 p.m. on Sundays, but I unfortunately don't have that luxury.
Hulu's a weird way to spell DVR. I don't understand how you get that pronunciation from it, but... So we're
here today to talk about the first two episodes of the season, which both aired Sunday night back to back. First one's called Welcome to the Alternate Economy. The second one's called The Land of Taking and Killing. Aaron, it's been like a year and a half. We talked a little bit about this in the preview, how long it's been. Sorry, not a year and a half, 3 years since this show has been on the air. How are you feeling about Fargo after the first two episodes?
I loved having Fargo back. It's very hard to find this blend of like drama and comedy, sometimes really broad comedy.
It
must be said. And just the style that Noah Hawley brings to the proceedings, not just visually, but sonically, like the music of Fargo is a work unto itself. I really enjoyed it. I do feel like it's going to take a long time to get my hands on all of the characters because this is a Game of Thrones situation where you have, you know, multiple competing families in a struggle and they've all got intergenerational alliances going. We're just scraping the surface of the police side of the Fargo equation. So there's going to be a lot of, okay, well, I got Roy Cannon and I got Jodo Fada down, but you get halfway down the bench on either side and I'm like, okay, you got Dr. Senator. It's hard to forget that name.
Sure, yeah, it's a good one.
Gaetano, I think I got that under my belt, but boy, it gets Satchel. I think there's a Satchel in there. There's a Swanee. There's a lot of improbably named people and they're all very colorful and distinct, and because of that, very hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
So, I really liked it. It felt really good to watch. What'd you think?
I'm the same way. This is maybe the most intrinsically interesting Fargo season for me, being somebody who's really into, you know, the Italian American experience as told through cinema. Godfather, we just did a Goodfellas review not too long ago.
La Familia, I get it. It speaks to you.
Absolutely. And also someone who lives in the Midwest, so it's got this like, vaguely, this is a little more Southern, right? Like this takes place in Kansas City, Missouri, which I think in previous seasons we've heard about the KC mob.
The Kansas City Mafia.
Yeah,
where Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Boys come from, which is interesting,
okay,
given Rabbi
connection.
Milligan. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it works here. You know, it's telling this multi-generational story, too. And it's one that's remarkably... modern. I don't know, it's something we're still struggling with, right? This idea of like Americans being a nation of immigrants and what that even means, and a lot of the narration that Ethel Rita has throughout the beginning of this series is kind of setting the stage for that conversation, and it's one that I find interesting. Like you said, it's just, this show kind of is effortless to watch. Like, it's always keeping you entertained either through the comedy or the drama that's putting on screen. And I don't know, every time I come back to Fargo, I'm just like, oh yeah, this feels warm and cozy, even when people are being murdered.
I do like it. I do miss, really, we've got Nurse Mayflower, right? That's her name. She's the only one that's kind of representing the stock Fargo accent that I've come to know and love. And I do miss that, but I'm glad we have Nurse Mayflower kind of a prominent representative of that, because there is something kind of sing-song and musically about the... I think there's poetry there when you have the Minnesota nice accent being employed for like murder and deception.
Absolutely.
And thievery. And you get a little, because like, you know, Nurse Mayflower, not really that nice.
No, very under the surface.
But yeah, I do miss all the people talking funny.
Sure. Yeah. And I think they needed that. I don't know if it feels like Fargo without that accent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Do you think Missouri is a southern state? Because I always think it's solidly Midwestern. Like, say,
it's,
you know,
it's that
St.
borderline.
Louis, Midwestern town, Kansas City.
Yeah. I would not call it solidly Midwestern. I would call it borderline between like Midwestern and Southern.
Midwestern?
South Midwestern? Western? I don't know.
South Central Western?
Yeah. So yeah, like I said, it takes place in Kansas City, Missouri, and it takes place from, you know, the 1900s to the mid 1900s. They start with this kind of montage that shows us these child exchanges, these keeping of the peace ceremonies and rituals that these different crime families have, these different gangs. And it goes back to the 1900s when, you know, the Hebrews, the Jews ran the organized crime aspects of America.
The Moskowitz gang, yeah.
Takes us through to the Irish taking over in the 20s, and then the Italians taking them over in the 50s or the 40s. And then, you know, eventually we get to the Black Mafia, which is kind of where the story, I think, in bulk is going to take place in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
It really sets a stage of like the players change, the game never does, you know?
Right, right. And they make a point of that like the people fresh off the boats, you know, America, nation of immigrants, the people fresh off the boats immediately go to war with the people that were off the boats ahead of them, because they come to the shores, the doors of the regular economy and commerce are closed to them. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of stuff in researching, reading the behind the scenes and stuff, that there's you know, a long history of discrimination against immigrants in this country. You know, like there's people had signs like, what was it? No, there's like an acronym called NINA, No Irish Need Apply, in shop windows. When, you know, and there's that came back with like the Italians as well, because, you know, it's handy that Irish and Italian stand it had the same initial letter, so sure. You don't have to change the acronym. Just, you know, Irish, no Italians need apply. You know, it's funny because, like, you know, every time you have a show, we saw this with Watchmen, we'll probably see it till the end of time. Anytime you have a show that touches on social issues, especially racism in America, people get upset about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I have a lot to talk about the social commentary, because we started this network called Swizzbold, where we talk about politics all the time. And I did a whole episode on this very topic, what whiteness means, what it means to become a naturalized American, that process that happens. I viewed it through the lens of my family's struggle being German immigrants. It's the third episode, 3 I Turn 6, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being, if you want to check it out. But like, I mean, it's all here. I think the people that get upset seem like they say that it's shoehorned because people in the 50s wouldn't talk this way, that this was like ahistorical opinions for like a little girl to have, or people, you know, like a black gangster and an Italian gangster. I don't find that very persuasive. This episode quotes Frederick Douglass, who was an escaped slave, speaking very passionately and eloquently about his status as a thief and a robber in society, since he stole his head, legs and body from his master and made off with these ill-gotten goods. Like, no, they've always been very whip smart and sharp people, talking about the bullshit that is the racial discrimination system in America.
And that kind of leans into the idea of the victors writing the history, right? Like,
right.
You know, because the people who did came out of that, you know, with power, they've kind of, you know, portrayed this image as like, oh, back then it was all fine. Nobody was thinking that way, you know? And
yeah,
it's actually not true. And also to try and like blanket say that no one thought this way, is foolish in any time period, right? Everybody thinks differently all the time.
Yeah. And this podcast, like, it's living proof. Like, you know, you and I are white, seen by white across all America, but yet you are the son of Italian immigrants. I'm the son mm-hmm. of German immigrants. 100 years ago, that we would not be considered, certainly not like the hospital administrator, you know, not Protestant white, surely not.
Right.
So it's a historical fact, and people are either uncomfortable with it or comfortable with it. And I find the people that are uncomfortable with it probably have a lot of unexamined privilege in their life, maybe, to throw out another word that pisses off people. But yeah, it's I thought it's really engaging and smart and neat and, as you say, interesting. And I thought it was very well, like, all this stuff was, like, through the lit. Like communicating this all through a fairly entertaining, essentially play that you see, where you've got the Moskowitzes giving way to the Milligans, giving way to the Fadas, giving way to maybe the Cannons.
We're kind of in the middle of that. We're plopped down right in the center.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it's great. The other big criticism I saw coming out of this, if I judge by the message boards and whatnot and the Reddits of the world, is the sidewalk scene, the crosswalk scene.
I love that. That's, to me, that made this scene, that made this first episode.
I do think this is kind of like, are you a Beatles fan or are you an Elvis fan type of question. Like, it gets to the type of person you are. Did you enjoy the fart attack?
Absolutely.
That Don Fada suffered in this episode, or didn't you? Because the thing is what I loved about it is it works as just a pure drama. Like, I was, like, on the edge of my seat,
you're
waiting.
Seeing the guys notice the people in the crosswalk, right? Get out of the car and prep for a gunfight. It's a lot of tension.
Yeah, yeah. The way they developed it, you got the kids, like, shooting guns, but they're not real guns. You got the guys crossing the streets, reaching in their pocket. That also, like, I'm surprised there wasn't any commentary about how what was going through my mind is, like, the crazy restraint these guys are showing, you know, like they're in this really tense situation. They're fearing for their life. People all around are splashing fake guns and real guns and reaching into pockets, and nobody's actually shooting first. And then this guy starts having his heart attack, and you think, oh, that's going to be the thing.
Right.
And then he just cuts loose with this long, crazy cinematic fart. And all of that tension just gets manufactured to me in just gut-busting laughter. Just the way it goes on. Uh-huh. Jason Schwartzman rolling his window down and hanging his head out the window. And then from that tragedy, an errant BB gun goes and nicks this guy in the artery. And suddenly everything that we were worried about is at all hell breaking loose happening anyway, but just not in the way... I don't know. Like, I think that's alchemy. That's turning lead to gold when you can generate tension into laughter, back right into tension. It's a magic trick, and I loved it. But a lot of people hated it.
I mean, look, a lot of people loved the aliens landing at the end of season two, right?
Sure.
We notoriously did not like that. So, you know, there's no accounting for taste.
Nope.
You like something or you don't, and... You know, I don't want to give people too much shit. I personally loved it. I thought the subversion there, like the triple layered subversion, really did it for me. And that release of tension with the release of the gas was perfect.
Yeah. Did you have any problems buying that a BB gun would nick an artery in such a way?
But
did you really?
I don't care. That's Fargo. Like,
okay. Like, if the only doubt in my mind, as a person who got like a hole ripped through him by a BB gun back in when I was 13 or 14, but the only doubt in my mind was it went through a glass window. Like, I would imagine that would take a lot. If it would just hit him right in the artery, hell yeah, that could hurt. Because they showed this little tiny pinhole.
Oh,
right,
okay.
But that's what I thought it was going to be, but then they actually showed this little tiny pinhole in that little, those weird little triangular dividing windows they have in old cars.
Yeah, yeah.
That you could probably crank out, you know? It went through that and got him. So, like, that seemed hard to believe, but you know what? The world's full of freak shit that happens. And I realize I'm making the exact same argument about the fucking fish NATOs and the alien stuff. You know, the world's full. How can you say for sure? But like, yeah, this is if you don't like this, I understand, because I didn't like some of the zigs that Fargo's served up over the years. But this one was right down. Plus, I also think that we'd be feeling different about this if this was episode 8, right?
Oh, and
like,
sure, yeah.
Like, Loy Cannon gets killed by an outrageous fart attack, improbable pellet incident. But as an inciting act, that kind of randomness, that, yeah, I felt it, it felt good. And again, man, I laughed as hard as I've laughed all year at that fart. Holy moly.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic. One fantastic fart. So you want to talk maybe about some of the characters, some of the main characters, because you mentioned the nurse, and I feel like she is a character that we've seen-ish in Fargo before. Yeah. Like she's akin to a Lauren Malva, right? She's the agent of chaos, the angel of death, that sort of thing. That supernatural force that always comes through in some way in a Coen Brothers film.
Yeah, and we talked about how Raising Arizona was one of the inspirations this year, and I mentioned I wonder if we'll see that like nefarious supernatural evil entity that was like that biker. I looked him up as Leonard Smalls is his name of his character.
Okay.
A Lorne Malvo. And again, Lorne Malvo, these people weren't literally like Batwing, smoke and brimstone, satanic. It's just they're evil, and there's a couple of scenes that might imply that there is a little bit more than just the laws of physics governing them. I remember, like, you know, in previous season, like, Lorne Malvo goes into a room that had, like, somehow gets in a room that had no exits, cuts the lights, and I felt like
the basement,
and I felt like this nurse, like, she's openly saying she's the angel of death, right?
Yeah.
And that scene where she comes out of that bus late at night is like, it's filmed like you're seeing an entity coming out of a portal from hell. Like an alternate dark dimension, and just she's got the prim uniform, all that stuff. Yeah, I'm thinking that she might be this slightly supernatural flavored character that I was looking for.
I find that interesting because like her Midwestern, you know, accent and the manners that, you know, typically come along with that in you know, pop culture and. You know, somewhat the real culture, sort of belie her underlying nastiness, right? The racism that she clearly exemplifies. So many of the other things that are just wrong about her as a person. I don't know, in a show that's, you know, clearly going to be about a bunch of bad people doing bad things. I feel like she's going to be the person who is like has this like good mannered affectation that is also doing the bad things, right? So you can sort of see like, oh, not all bad people present as very bad people.
Yeah, because she's very careful to. In fact, I thought they were going to play that racism as obliviousness, like when she had this scene where she meets Ethelrita, one of the other main characters of the show. And, you know, she's got white dad, black mom. Mm-hmm. And the dad introduces herself as because she's, you know, she's a nurse and she's such a caring, loving nurse that she shows up to the funerals of her patients. What a great gal.
Sure.
But there's this like long comic beat where she's looking between Ethelrita and her father and back and forth and back and forth. And then she goes, oh, now I see it. And I thought there is going to play like Minnesota Nice, like, oh, I see the family. It's got nonsensical non sequitur. Mm-hmm. You betcha. I see it. And then she just then rolls on with like, you're the project of miscegenation. I can't. It's an old fuddy duddy racist term. It means intermixing of races.
Yeah.
And then says a whole bunch of other racist shit right on top of it. And her father, I don't know. It's like I said, there's so much like commentary here where the dad kind of not excusing it, but like, you know, doing the well-meaning thing of like, oh, you know, they're missed. Instead of being like, hey, kid, you know, that was super racist and she was racist right to your face. Try to be like, oh, you know, she's a weirdo and she's misunderstood and she says a bunch of silly stuff.
Yeah, there's another scene there where she's at the dinner table and she's noticed some strange men in the house. She asks about it and her parents just tell her, look, don't think about that. Don't concern yourself with it. We'll take care of it. We're your parents, you know, just I don't know. They try and keep her out of the loop on that stuff. And, you know, rightfully so. I think she's 16 years old. That's really their prerogative to do that. But at the same time, I don't know. It's a weird sort of like sheltering her from the realities of the world, even though it doesn't seem to have worked, right? Like she seems very world wise. She speaks many different languages. That's another thing I like that they're doing with Orietta and Ethelreda is they both seem to be equally capable. You know, they're both speaking French, like they're putting them on the same level there. And then one of them just has this superior attitude.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of the scenes in Tombstone where you've got Doc Holliday and there's this I forget the guy's name. He's played by the dude that James Cameron loves, Michael Bane. They're these kind of both gangsters and Doc Holliday, but, you know, he's a doctor, he's a dentist, I guess, and he's got an education. He speaks Latin to this guy as a way to shine him on, and the guy speaks Latin back, and suddenly, because he was debating, he's like, I'm not sure if I like this guy or not. And then when the guy speaks Latin back, he's like, nope, I've decided I hate him. Yeah. Like, it's that kind of thing where, you know, Nurse Mayflower retreats to this. She's got several defenses. The first line is her Minnesota nice. When that fails, she has this intellectual superiority she retreats to. And then when you chase her back into that, then the real nasty comes out. Yeah. And to the extent that Nurse Mayflower seems to be racist, which is a pretty big extent, I feel like the fact that this is a young black girl coming at her with these intellectual weapons is like really provocative. And it's even something Ethelreda says, like, the only thing worse than being a disreputable Negro is to be an upstanding one.
Yeah.
You know, like those are the two targets that you can place on your back here in America. And unfortunately, like that fucking shit heated up real quick. By the end of the episode two, she's making a poison pie.
Yeah, let's maybe talk about that. She's making, you know, Ethelreda and you know, by extension, the Smutney family, her project, as she says. Mm-hmm. And in that Lauren Malvo way, like that agent of chaos, like Lauren Malvo strolls through a parking lot and tells a kid he probably needs to piss in his mom's gas tank, right? And the kid goes and does it. This feels a little bit like that with this pie. I don't know what her longer term game plan is. But this pie seems almost like just this petty spite thing that I don't quite get, but I'm interested to see where they go with it.
Yeah, because I did some research. The syrup of Ipecac is a discontinued product that they used to give to children to get them to vomit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, supposedly if, you know, Billy ate a Tide Pod, you know, give him some Ipecac and he'll spit it all out. That turns out that that's like bad medicine. It's not very effective at clearing the system of toxins. If it's something caustic, you don't want to bring it back up. You want to absorb it with charcoal or dilute it. There's all kinds of modern ways you got to do that. But like, you don't want people usually, and mostly it got associated with a lot of like a Munchausen by proxy syndrome where, you know, adults would give children this and make them ill on command, essentially, in the guise of giving them medicine. And it's also got attached to a lot of bulimic people who wanted to you know, this is, I guess, a V.M. Varga a tie-in. But you can't buy it now because it just didn't have any therapeutic use. And it's poisonous in large doses. The dose to get an adult to vomit is like 1 to 2 tablespoons. And it didn't seem like she added that much to the pie. But what would probably happen is that like it would cause everyone in the house to like have belly ache or cramps. And there's some people suggesting that maybe this is her way of. Yeah, you think that the.
Look, this is television. This is not a scientific documentary. Epicac is known, you know, in pop culture, in common.
To make you sick.
Yeah, it makes you vomit. That's the point of Epicac to the vast majority of people. That's what they're doing here, right?
But to what end is Mayflower doing? Is it just something she's doing to be cruel? Or like some people suggested, I saw an idea, there's a theory that she's going to make the whole house sick so that they... you know that weird white lady? She's a nurse. Maybe she can help us. And then that will, you know, get her more firmly entwisted in the family. But I feel like that's not what I would do. If some weird white lady, creepy white lady stepping out of a hell bus gave me a pie after having these weird relations with me, and then everyone in the family got sick after eating that pie, I'd be like, nah, the weird white lady's out to get us. But like you said, it's a TV show. I'm not sure if everyone's going to behave that rationally.
I mean, I could totally see that reaction because, yeah, that's what I'd have too.
You keep mentioning the Lorne Malvo, and I know like this, you know, this is an anthology, so you don't really need to see any of the other seasons to understand any of the other seasons, but there are, you know, like there are echoes that go backwards and forwards. One of them that I think ties Mayflower to the Lorne Malvo type of character is in the scene where she meets Jodo. And she's kind of taking care of him, prescribing him all these, you know, illegal medications. He says the word aces to her when she says that she's going to take care of her dad, which is, you know, that was one of Malvo's catchphrases, too. So I think that really does kind of make her into this the dark supernatural type ish character.
Yeah.
The other thing, there's a scene in the end of this first episode where, you know, she gets off the hell bus. Ethel Reed is out on the front porch. It's freezing cold. Her dad comes out and kind of like comforts her, says he's going to read The Wizard of Oz. And then it pans up and over to this very impressive, visually interesting yellow building. And Ethel's at the top, or not Ethel, Nurse Mayflower's at the top. She's muttering to herself. But when they pan across the street, there is a dude, a creepy dude, standing in the middle of this street that the camera just kind of pans over. A lot of people missed it.
I did.
But I'm wondering if there is some kind of, I do think that person's supposed to be noticed. Some person pointed out, and I went back and rewound it, and I kind of heard it, that there is, when the camera pans over this person, like the sound of like a rope swinging. You know, the sound like a thick rope makes when it's knotting, and, you know, and they just mentioned the Wizard of Oz in the scene before, because that's what her dad wanted to read. And do you know the lore of Wizard of Oz, that there's like this urban legend about one of the dwarfs, one of the little people actors that was in the Lollipop gig, hanging himself on set? And you can actually see him swinging in the background of some of these scenes.
I've heard that. Yeah.
Some people theorize that there's a connection there. I don't know. If I had to guess, I'd say it's Timothy Oliphant casing the place, from what I'd seen from the second episode, right? Mm-hmm. But I just want to throw that out. If you wanted to go and do some frame by frame analysis and some sound analysis and come up with a theory about how a haunted little person Lollipop Guild could come back and form an alliance with this evil demon nurse, then please send that in to Fargo@ballboob.com. I'd love to hear it. But sure.
There are other supernatural type elements around her, like there's the scene, you know, that was in the trailers, and actually most of, if not everything in the trailer, was in these first two episodes. So you have,
which I always love seeing. I always love seeing
that.
You got
a lot of new material that we're going to get for the next
right,
18 episodes. I have no idea how many. But yeah, it's the scene where they're, you know, Jason Schwartzman asks, "Hey, you got any drugs?" They go back into this room and they do drugs together.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And then there's an exchange between them that is very like Italian mafia coded language, like you know, he's in a lot of pain, you know, it's make sure you take care of him, right? Like that kind of stuff, which a normal nurse would not read into that, probably, even if she knew, oh, these guys are Italian, they're mafia. Normal nurse probably not going to read into that and go kill the guy. This nurse does, but when she's in that room, she walks in, and I get the impression that he's in like a coma or something. She walks in, she says one word to him. The guy in the corner is asleep the entire time.
Yes, she makes no effort to be stealthy.
Unable to wake up. And she wakes this man with a single word, and I think that's supposed to give you like this supernatural feeling to her.
One other thing I have a question about Nurse Mayflower is, you know, she's got two interactions of note, one with Ethel Rita and one with Jodo. I agree with you. Do you actually think that Jodo meant to suggest that someone should take care of his father? I think they played it that way. But here's the she heard that message delivered on the goods, which she might have done anyway, because that's kind of her shtick, it seems like.
Yeah.
But then she tries at the funeral to like press Jodo about it, like, hey, I did that favor for you, we should talk about it, and he completely rebuffs her. That can't be good, right?
Yeah.
If this is some warlock witch type character that you owe a favor to, and you just like fucking slam the door shut on her, that's not, there's going to be some boil toil and trouble in your future, I would think.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I'm interested to see how the Italian versus Black Mafia thing goes, but I don't think it's going to go the Italian way. Given right, you know right. what we know about our actual modern history.
Yeah, what do you think is going to come of her being fired from the hospital, St. Bartholomew?
I don't know, because she immediately goes in on this project against the Smutneys that she's got. So yeah. I don't know if she needs money. I don't know if she, you know, is just. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I really don't know.
I wonder if it's going to go, because also Jodo said, you know, we're going to talk about this eventually, I imagine, but Jodo got rebuked by my man, is it Jack Houston?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if they've established his name, the real twitchy OCD police officer on the FATA payroll.
Yeah.
He gets rebuked for like, hey, you can't take this open action against this was this name really Harvard? Is that this guy's name? The hospital administrator?
I don't know. I know him as hospital administrator.
The hospital administrator, you can't take direct action against them. But we also know that Nurse Mayflower is going to have 2 months of severance and a glowing recommendation from St. Bartholomew.
Fair.
I wonder if she's going to wind herself over there and she's going to exact some kind of revenge on him that way.
Could be.
But then that'd be Jodo cashing in another favor. And then where is this all leading to? What's she want from him? That's what I think is going to be really interesting.
Yeah. How many deals can you make with the devil before he claims your soul?
Have we mined all the stuff out of Nurse Mayflower?
She's into astrology. Is that a thing in any other Coen brothers films? Is this pulling from something? Okay.
I don't know. Nothing off the top of my head. It might be a commentary in the how that, like, I feel like astrology is really making a comeback in the last few years. I notice a lot of the young, the friends that I roll with and in the Gen X and millennial cohort, a lot of people are taking an interest in astrology. And it's one of those things that kind of like I cock my eyebrow at, because like everyone says their superstition and, anti-science bullshit is fun and games until it's deadly serious, in my opinion. And I don't know. I do know that astrology is dumb and made up, and it doesn't have any real predictive value in the world. But hey, if you wanted to read them for fun, I guess, why not? Sure. That doesn't seem scary to me at all. I just wonder if it's just like a passing shot at that kind of phenomenon. Like, huh.
Yeah, that's pseudoscientific thinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
What do we make of Ethel Rita's family? What'd you say their last name is?
Smutney,
that's right. They got this interesting racket. That's not a racket. It's a legitimate business where they've got a mortuary that, because of the biracial nature of the home, they're able to serve both interests in Kansas City. You know, the white family goes to see the dad. The black family goes to see the mom. You would think that would be making a lot of money, but there's this interesting reference that their last state inspection went badly.
Yeah.
And a couple other things. Ethel Rita has this clandestine meeting with a boy to get formaldehyde. Did you pick up on that?
Uh-huh.
Like, why can't her dad, who's a mortician, just get formaldehyde?
Well, they may not have, like, their license at the moment, right? Like, I don't know.
That if severe of trouble.
Yeah, if the inspection went that bad, maybe they don't. They can't even operate.
Holy shit.
Although
Holy
it's
shit.
Clear they're still doing services, right? So
right, yeah. They have to be doing something like it, but maybe, yeah, they're getting the formaldehyde on the sly. I don't know.
Yeah. It's clear to me that they're going to be some kind of, they already are some kind of bridge, you know, between the races here, with, mm-hmm. you know, it being a mixed race household. That kind of thing obviously is not looked on very kindly in that time period, in that place. And I think even more than that, that could be the link that Canon is looking for with the credit card scheme they've got going, the credit card business. Because they talk whole bunch about, like, oh, the black families, the black businesses around the community are running, you know, these credit card operations, mm-hmm. with all their customers, but they need to break into the white community so that when this hits the big time, they won't just be, you know, their business won't be usurped and squashed by the white folk. This could be the link into the white community through this mixed race family.
I wonder how they do that, because, like, it seems like the credit that they're being extended is an issue already by the end of the second episode, that the rate's already 10% per month and is going
up from there. Yeah.
Like, the one thing that could save them is a gang war, though, because, boy, that's a way of really boosting business. And they're uniquely suited to serve both sides of the war at that point, you know?
Yeah, you're not wrong. There are services they provide that the gang war needs. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, you've got a very clearly very wealthy black mafia here who's running banking operations for their community. Mm-hmm. They could come in and clear that debt, I'm sure. You know, for the right favor, in that case could just be them using credit cards for the white half of their business, right?
I guess the problem with that theory is Raylan Givens is kicking in their door. Raylan, of course, is the character that Timothy Olyphant played for 6 seasons over on Justified. I didn't catch his name in this episode, but he is a federal agent of some sort. Mm-hmm. Is he there because of the Canon connection, or is he there because it's the two escaped convicts? And is it even the same connection? Because the ladies claim, and I don't know what you think of this claim, but Zelmare Roulette and Swanee Cap.
Uh-huh.
Did you recognize Swanee? Because you've seen her before.
I know I have. I can't remember from where.
She's played by Amber Midthunder, who was Carrie, the female Carrie twin from Legion. Remember the gal who could split apart in the two people?
Uh-huh.
I don't know that she's been in much else. I think she was in an episode or two of Banshee. I didn't even recognize her until I looked it up. But they say that they broke out because they heard that Zelmare's? Ethelreda's mom is Zelmare's sister, I think. Yeah. But they heard that they were getting in debt to this Canon operation and broke out to help him out, like, you know, mano a mano style. So
yeah,
he could be there if he's in a role of U.S. Marshal, because, like, what the Marshal Service does a lot is, you know, go after escaped criminals and convicts and whatnot. Yeah. Or he could be there to investigate some kind of mob connection with the Black Mafia.
They Timothy Olyphant runs up to the house, he kicks in the door, and he kicked in my heart too, because the episode ends there, and I was looking forward to Marshall Olyphant going ham on these people.
The whole 2 hours, I was like, okay, all uh-huh. right, there's Houston, all right, there's the one cop that showed up, oh, he's working for the Fadas, okay, interesting, okay, now where's fucking Olyphant?
Right.
Where's Deadwood? Where's Justified? I need that injected into my veins. And I thought, yeah, I got massive case of cinematic weekly television blue balls by them cutting the black right there.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to next week, though. More than ever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be real, real good. Where do we want to go from here?
I like those two, that pair that escaped from prison. I don't know why.
Real fun.
There's something, yeah, there's something fun about them. There's an energy there.
I think that's
those
a raising
are doing great stuff.
That's the Raising Arizona kind of energy that they're bringing, the escaped convict.
Also the Oh Brother Where Art Thou kind of energy.
You're right.
There's
you're
some
right.
country music playing as they're escaping mm-hmm. prison, and I think like they're definitely invoking that film.
Yeah, like robbing a fancy high society lady for her lipstick and stockings, then
robbing
some cowboy wanting to give free mustache rides or whatever he was doing. I their introduction was a hoot. It was a lot of fun. 100%. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they end up. And they seem like they're fairly dangerous people.
I guess one of the things that wasn't in these first two episodes from the trailer was that, girl, you got a panty on your head. That thing. So I'm looking
Direct.
Forward to when they start doing jobs. You know, apparently the marshal is not going to bust in there and capture them today.
Apparently. That's a direct Raising Arizona reference from the trailer. We forgot to mention something with Mayflower. When she killed the head of the Fada, the Don Fada, she sucked off his ring. Right from his finger.
Right.
Yeah. That could have gone a lot of places. Which was really creepy and disturbing. Is it going to go anywhere? Because we saw the mother was like weeping and wailing and accusing one of the sons of stealing it because you couldn't wait till his body. Is that like the ring? Like the ring that people kiss? Like that's the symbol of family power ring? Like is that going to be... maybe that's a direction we can go to next to talk about the uneasy, I don't know, sharing of power that Jodo and Gaetano, is that his name? Gaetano?
Old world versus the new world, yeah.
Yeah, old world versus new world. Is that ring going to figure centrally?
No, that's a good question. I think it is supposed to be that symbolic family ring. Yeah, it's what are they going to do with that? I don't really know.
Because they do, it's something you're supposed to notice. Mm-hmm. He's very prominently stolen. They bring it up again. And, Jodo's kind of like, whatever, mom. So maybe it's not going to be anything, but they mentioned it. And I don't know, like, I feel like in a real life mafia, they just make a new ring. You know, like maybe they probably kill a couple people, torture a few people to see it, who stole it, you know. But then they just get a new ring. I can't imagine that it would be some kind of like fucking the one ring from Sauron that has to be gotten or no one can rule Middle Earth, you know?
I don't think it's going to reduce their power, but I think it's something that, you know, it's symbolic of so much. Like there's one line that they have where I think it's Gaetano says, the mantra, it's business, family, country. And I think that ring represents like all three of those things to them. So it's symbolically very important, assuming it's the ring that we think it is.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
You know, it's funny because, like, when I see Jason Schwartzman, and I'd never seen this guy that they got playing Gaetano.
Apparently, he's in Italian, syndicate.
Yeah, this show called Gomorrah.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of well-regarded. But I thought that they were going to be kind of, like, jokey characters. You know, I see this guy. He's kind of like this chubby dude. I'm thinking this is going to be, like, a Laurel and Hardy. No, he's the heavy.
Yeah.
And from what I know, two episodes in, I don't like Jodo seems very Fredo and, Gaetano's looking very Sonny.
Yeah.
From a Godfather perspective, I don't think that Jodo can win this fight. Like, I feel like Gaetano is made for the land of taking and killing. And yeah. Jodo was raised in the land of kind of like giving and receiving, like, you know, kind of business is business. How the hell does Jodo win over that? Unless he maybe him and Loy, Loy picks his pocket and an offer of protection or something like that.
Yeah, Loy being Chris Rock's character. Okay, look, I like Jason Schwartzman. In almost everything I've seen him in, probably everything I've seen him in, maybe sure. Up until now,
big fan.
I don't think he's bad in this. I just think there are much better choices. He brings the comedy element, certainly, that you want in that character. But I don't know that he brings the seriousness to me. It's tough to take him seriously in this role. And it's not really his fault. I just think that's the kind of actor he is.
Well, but Holly's not an idiot. He's no fool. Sure. He knows Jason Schwartzman's kind of stature and reputation coming into it. Like, he can play off menacing in like a Scott Pilgrim production when right. He's facing off against another fairly unimpressed. Yeah. You can bully Michael Cera, Jason Schwartzman. Absolutely. I believe you can bully Michael Cera. Raging Bull, fresh off the boat from Sicily. I don't know so much, but they make it clear that he's got the political connections.
Sure.
He's fucking one of the alderman's daughters. He's forging these political alliances. Maybe that's what he's going to have because, I guess if you have muscle on the streets and you got muscle in like City Hall, you'd probably rather have the City Hall muscle, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're both useful, but like one is a lot more useful than the other.
You've got the police force on your side, which right. becomes your muscle,
Right. So. They can just execute people legally
right.
today and back in 1950s for sure.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's going to be because I don't know. I want to say it's like, well, Jason Schwartzman's the smart one and the Gaetano is the dumb one. But I don't even get that. Like, he mentions this Il Duce. Do you know they're referring to Mussolini?
Yeah.
And apparently I don't know much about Mussolini's connections with the Italian mafia. That's a whole new era of research I'd have to undergo. And I don't particularly want to. But he's representing that, like, you know, they essentially were the power behind the throne and they swept that power away. They were the ones that hung him up. So apparently got a Sucrette's tin of his teeth. He keeps in his pocket to remind him of business, family. What was it?
Country. Yeah, he put business, and family, obviously, ahead of country there.
Yeah. I don't know. It's really early in the scorecard, but like I feel like just Gaetano's way ahead. He is the muscle. He's the one that looks like they're going to be running the cannons off of the property.
Yeah, as much as I'm not like a big fan of Schwartzman in this role, I think Chris Rock was the other side of that coin. Like I was pretty impressed by his performance. It's not flashy. I don't think it's perfect, but it is. There's an intelligence behind it.
Yes.
That really worked for me. I hadn't expected that from a guy that I don't think I've ever seen do drama.
Also, I think I've seen him in a couple of Saturday Night Live appearances in the last few years, but I would have been shocked to see how old he's playing, too. Like I feel like when I think of Chris Rock, he's eternally frozen into like that, like 90s HBO comedy series, run around dropping a microphone, wearing a leather suit kind of stuff. Now he's getting to be old. He's an old man now.
Sure.
And I thought it was interesting. So this process of, exchanging sons as hostage, this is, going back to talking about the Game of Thrones, this is straight out of the Game of Thrones playbook, right? What utility does it have? Is this some kind of bizarre game of rock, paper, scissors? Because they do a brief recounting of the gangster history of Kansas City, and at no time did exchanging the sons ever lead to any peace. And this process repeated like every 10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
Is this some kind of weird, like it's a meta game? Like it's like rock, paper, scissors, where there's some psychology behind it? Because it seems both people go into this knowing that this is not something that solves things. This is just yet another level of political posturing.
And I think that's entirely the point, like the cyclical nature of like the futility of trying to change things. Those patterns that people and society get stuck in that just perpetuate themselves over and over again because people are, just reluctant to try another way, definitely is supposed to be there.
Do you think there's some foreshadowing because Rabbi Milligan was the twice jilted son of the Irish mafia that kind of rebelled against his father the second time? In fact, I thought it was a very confusing scene.
It was.
It didn't immediately occur to me that that was the same boy that they exchanged. And it was like I thought. So I finally caught up to that. But like, what do you make of the fact that like the hostages are being treated very differently in the Fada versus Cannon family?
I feel like
that's at the end,
like
the Fada kids eating with the family for Thanksgiving, this modest feast where the Fadas are over there enjoying this lavish the table groaning with all this food, and then upstairs with the neglected rabbi. Poor satchel's eating alone, just two slices of stale bread and water. Like,
yeah, to me, it was very much of a piece with the forward looking, canon versus the status quo Fadas. You know, like this child exchange thing was something that, Cannon's going along with simply because that's the only way to keep the peace and bide your time while you're forward looking with your credit card schemes, your banking schemes, you're forward looking with, your patience, just saying, hey, we're going to slowly move in here and take this over before, they realize what's happened. We'll have their business, that kind of thing. I feel like there's much more forward looking in the Black Mafia side of this thing than there is in the Italian mafia side. And I think that's just what they're going for. This new generation is smarter. Like, cause if you look at how, like you said, how the Italian child is being treated in the Black home, it's they're making him part of the family. Like they're genuinely bringing him in. Whereas the other kid is being treated like an outsider the entire time.
Yeah. Like Loy's actually trying to like, you're not my kid, but you're my responsibility. So I'm going to teach you a couple things. Like, here's how you know when people respect you. Here's how you know when people are doing like, whereas, and I feel like that there's something in that, like, you saw how the child was treated, in the little history lesson they gave. And it seemed like that's pivotal to who wins the war. Yeah. Well, I mean, it might be giving away the plot that, and plus, I've seen American Gangster. I know how this goes.
Right.
Might be giving a plot away that, like, Loy's doing the right thing and doing right by this kid, and that's going to be good for him in the long run.
Yeah. Part of the message, of this immigrant story of America, right? That, like, it doesn't matter the color of your skin or the background that you have, what country you come from. Like, you're all here doing the same thing, and if you treat each other with respect, that works out for you in the long term. Whereas if you treat each other like outsiders and stay insular, you get run over by the next guy who doesn't. Right.
I thought that was those key differences in how they treated are interesting. I really like the gang politics. I could listen to Loy and Dr. Senator strategize all day long.
Yeah.
And Dr. Senator is actually a legit doctor too. Didn't they say he's a PhD in economics?
Yeah.
Right. I thought that was the interview they had with the banker was really funny, but like them trying to like, well, you know, you got the two different types of lions, and you know, them being like patient and bold, and you know, one of them caged, and that's Johto, I guess, is the caged lion, which I thought was wild. And versus the one on the wall, but like them coming to the idea of like, you know what, this guy died right after a meeting. Let's just, you asked him about the stockyards. Let's act like he just gave it to us, and you know, like see what happens. I thought that was really, that's really interesting. Like, you know, hey, we don't know, like they don't have their heads together, but they got this new guy that looks like he's strong. Let's just probe their flanks. Let's probe their weaknesses. Let's see what we can get away with. And I thought the scene of them going in and taking over the stockyards was really funny. Dr. Senator's like remark about the rats, like, I think you're overestimating your foe's intelligence and comprehension. It's great because it's a great line, but also feels very heavy with portent and foreshadowing too.
And I love the way they're using the cow killing machines. In that scene, it's a lot like the cap guns they were, and the BB gun that they were using earlier. It serves to ratchet up the tension and keep everybody on edge. That's good stuff.
I like all the musical cues associated with the Cannon Gang. Like every time you're looking at their machine operating, like this garage where it's like they're running numbers, massive amounts of money going through because of the credit stuff, and the money counting machines going off, and it's all got this kind of like really jazzy improvisational stuff going on, but like up tempo. I thought that was really good.
The music in the show is very good. Has always been very good, but it's kind of a different vibe this season. You know, they're using the different flavors of the different crime organizations to influence what music they're playing. Like a lot of the Italian family's stuff is like solo piano kind of tunes.
Right.
In that very like world, 30s gangster kind of vibe, which I really liked. And then, like you said, the horns and the jazz and stuff for the Cannon family.
I can't wait till that starts. I bet that stuff is going to start really going into a duet by the time you get like some gang lanes. That's going to like mix in a very interesting way, I bet. I bet. But no, I really like that. There's another character that kind of like stepped forward into the camera for us to take notice of, this Leon Whittle, who tries to impress Dr. Senator before with his grasp of education and strategy before the raid on the stockyard, which I thought was amazing. They run in, it looks like you're gearing up for an Anchorman fight. Guy's got like a hook and a baseball bat, an ice pack. One guy's got a shotgun. Yeah. He just gets introduced. Nothing much comes of it. But I think he's stepping forward as maybe a main character that's going to be developed on the FADA side. I'm not sure who we're supposed to take. They got their consigliere, whose name I don't know. They got the Jack Houston as the WEF detective. And they got the two main guys, but Cannon, it's clearly you got Loy, you got Dr. Senator, and you got this Leon Whittle.
Yeah.
He's the cousin of somebody I didn't catch.
Yeah, Happy. I don't think we know who that is. Unless Happy's his name cousin, was captioned in the original, you know, meeting of the two families. I don't know. The other scene that I really loved was that banking scene, and you mentioned it briefly. But they go in and they pitch this
a financial instrument.
Yeah, but they're
pitching a financial instrument. To a savings and loan. Yeah.
Yeah, to this banker. It's just really funny. Like the set pieces they use illustrate everything you need to know. They come in with this like very, very futuristic sort of thing, right? They're using new technologies and plastic to create lightweight cards that people can use to look like they're rich, look like they're wealthy. And you know, his response is, oh, that's not what banks do, taking advantage of people. That's not a bank's business, which obviously that's going to change somewhere along the line.
And there's this like, it's such a great scene because they juxtapose this very, like we know credit cards are going to, for good or ill, transform finances and consumer consumerism across the world, right? Mm-hmm. And they juxtapose this with this creaky old guy who's using pneumatic tubes to communicate.
Yeah.
Like, I just love it. And the thing is like, a lot of people made it like, well, this guy's just not going to hear the black guys out. And there's definitely an element of that. But I also think what he said about like charging high interest rates and deceiving people and getting them to live, that's not what banking's all about. That's a point, too, because I think that's kind of what banking used to be about. Like, you know, think about that was something that was in A Wonderful Life, right? You got Jimmy Stewart. It's a good banker. He's there for the community. He's there for everyone. That's how people build houses. That's how people grow businesses. That's how people get the American dream. And you got the other banker who's just like a vulture taking over everybody.
Yeah.
I feel like there was a war for the soul of banking in this country, and the soulless vampires won. Like, this guy's bank got bought out by fucking Chase Manhattan, JP Chase Manhattan, like 20 years ago. And they didn't, because that's what happened to me. I used to bank at a small town bank. It got sold to a regional bank that got sold to a national bank that got sold to fucking Chase. And that's what, you know, I never moved my accounts. I just got shifted up to this global conglomerate. Yeah. They'll absolutely fuck you for money. That's what banking's all about. I thought it worked both ways. It could be racism. It could just be old school versus, it could be Jimmy Stewart versus, I forget the evil villain of the, God damn it! What was it? Hooterville? He had the Ville,
right? Potterville.
Remember?
It's Potterville.
Potterville. It was the old man Potter, evil old man Potter.
Yeah.
The final thing I want to talk about is an artistic touch, and maybe this was in other Fargo seasons. I don't remember it. It felt like something that Holly kind of innovated in Legion, but the almost comic book style division of frames. Where you have this, like, you know, these scene transitions where they have multiple takes and angles that are all kind of sliding and transforming and informing each other. What did you think of that? Because I thought it, at first I thought, well, this is kind of like gimmicky, but then the more they did it, the more I'm like, oh, okay, this is actually, they're accentuating isolation of characters. They're showing alliances forming. They're showing, the theme of this episode is transitions of power and whatnot. I thought that some of that visual imagery and metaphor worked really well in these two episodes. What did you think of it?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The only one that I can really note, actually there were two. The one that I remember mostly is, I think when they were showing the outlaws escaping from prison, they did one that looked sort of like bars over the top of them, you know, like cell bars. And then there was another one where they transitioned. I want to say it was maybe the banking thing where they transitioned with some bullets in the top frame, the scene in the middle frame, and then an American flag in the bottom frame, which I thought was interesting. But yeah, I don't know. I'm looking forward to how they use it as the season goes on.
Yeah, there's so much foreshadowing too, because like they mentioned Ethelreda has this kind of persistent voiceover, which is another Raising Arizona nod.
Yeah.
The high's running commentary throughout the scene, the salad days, and my wife's womb is a rocky place where my seed could not take purchase. But she mentions that it's you know, you get fat and complacent, and then the person that's hungrier takes you over. And I couldn't help but thinking about that in all the other foreshadowing of like the canon's eventual victory over the Fattas. It came down to that Thanksgiving scene where like it's not like the canons were starving, but their table was modestly set and they're actually celebrating Thanksgiving in kind of like an almost devout kind of way. You know, like Loy's taking a stab at being thankful about the kind of, you know, good old fashioned American values, essentially, you know, like, Lord, you filled this land with injustice to give us something to do. You made us strong so we can protect the weak. You made the meek to inherit the earth. And there's all this stuff. And then you go to the Fada's table and it's like huge. It's just groaning with food. Everybody's eating and drinking to the detriment of the weak outsider members of their family, Rabbi Milligan and all that. I thought that was really great. And then the other thing is, you know, people like to spot the connections to seasons. And we've made a passing reference, but I want to make it explicit. Mike Milligan, one of the best things in season 2, was sent as an enforcer from the Kansas City Mafia. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Milligan, white guy who is essentially the guardian of this adopted black boy. Connection? Did we just see Mike Milligan's Oregon story?
I mean, his name is Satchel.
Oregon origin story? Right? Satchel. That's not a proper name. If you're going to go, if you're going to go travel, you got to take a name like Mike.
Sure. Yeah, his undercover name.
Because he had all the forward-thinking business ideas for his bosses that they weren't ready for, too. Like, there's a lot of similarities.
Maybe.
And like
it's
I said,
totally possible.
I hope this doesn't put off anybody that I talked into watching season four, because like this happens. There's always this fun little spec. It's exactly the same way of American Horror Story when, you know, like, oh, this takes place and wasn't that the state that they say had the spooky insane asylum and didn't that nurse have? It's that kind of like, you know, expanded universe kind of fun that we're having here. I really don't think it's going to, it might inform your, if you go back and watch season two of Fargo, it might inform that experience, but
yeah,
I don't think it's going to have anything to do but just a fun name game.
No, whenever Fargo does this, none of it matters to the plot of the current season. So you're not going to miss anything if you don't know who Mike Milligan is.
Right. It's just a fun little spot the connection game we're playing.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say about, I mean, I could probably talk forever because there was a ton of characters and a ton of history and a lot of notes, but it's a great episode. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this all plays out in the weeks and months ahead. Do you want to consider some feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
We don't have a lot this week, and it probably has something to do with the fact that Fargo@baldmove.com was misdirected into the void. One intrepid person had something that they wanted to be heard on, so they got the bounce message and they sent it to our general inbox, and I thank you for doing that. Because it's a really cool story.
It's rectified now, right?
We have fixed it. So okay. If you want to send us feedback from now on, you can do so at fargo@baldmove.com. Also, forums.baldmove.com has discussion threads on the episodes. That might be a good place to discuss it as well. But Mark and Rogers Park wrote in. They did a lot of filming in his hometown of this season. And he sent us a lot of nice pictures. Says, I'm a big fan of your Fargo podcast. In your preview podcast for the new season of Fargo, Aaron remarked that the COVID-related delay releasing the show in September instead of April is good in at least one way, because the snow seems to fit better in autumn or winter anyway. He also hoped to see snow on the ground during the season. Let me assure you, you will. How do I know? Because a house on my street less than a block away from mine was a location for this season, the King of Tears Mortuary.
Okay. That's the Smutney family's business.
Yeah, yeah. I live in Chicago's northernmost lakeside neighborhood, Rogers Park, and I got to watch the process for several weeks scattered between last November and February of this year, and then again in the first week of this month when the show returned to get the final 2 days of necessary shooting to wrap the season. We did not have much snow provided by nature while we were here, while they were here last winter, but it was cold enough that snow generated by machines could be added. Attached are some pictures I took of the location, as well as many of the vintage vehicles staged in the street near my house. The bus, for example, is parked right across the street from me when I took that picture. These were a lot of fun. I asked for his permission. I imagine he'll give it to me, but I asked for his permission to publish some of these photos on our official Twitter @baldmove. If you want to see some of the behind the scenes, there's no spoilers. But yeah, you definitely see snow on the ground, which I'm happy to see. Didn't see it in this episode, but you know what? We just got to Thanksgiving. I wouldn't expect a lot of snow on the ground in Kansas City before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. But looking forward to seeing it later as the winds of the war blow cold.
Yeah, that's one thing we didn't talk about that we should probably mention is the costuming is great. And Fargo always has great costuming. Noah Hawley, in general, always works with great costumers. But this stuff, the way they've, you know, delineated the families just with their looks it works really well for me. Like seeing, you know, just, oh, the Irish are wearing different hats, right? It's kind of easy to do it with the Jews because they have their own attire for sure.
Sure.
But then even like, you know, the Black Mafia has their own set of like hats and coats that are similar but different. And like,
sure.
I don't know. I wonder what the underworld gangs look like now. Is it all just like t-shirts,
track suits
and sweatpants?
For moderns, it's a lot of track suits and gold chains and
Yeah.
You know, Eastern European accents, I'm gathering.
All right. It's a lot of John Wick stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's being like, and you wonder, like, I've heard that some of that stuff is like eating its own tail, like popularized depictions of things, shape.
Oh, sure.
You know, like how people, and then like, then that shapes things, the like depictions, and it's just like, you know, narcissistic cycle that they go through.
But those cars, like he mentioned, you know, those being on his block, those are beautiful cars.
They are
all kinds too. I saw like Plymouths and Lincolns and Fords and Mercurys. It's just, yeah, every flavor of those old timey cars, that they're really good looking.
Big white walls. Big, yep. Huge mayonnaise white walls on these things that you don't really see much today.
Yeah.
But no, it's cool, and I'm glad you sent. Actually, I just checked the mailbox. He did grant me pictures to release to release these pictures. So I'll be posting some of them on the Bald Move Twitter feed later today if you want to check that out. But yeah, I think that's a Fargo podcast. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, we can slow down and do it an episode at a time. Mm-hmm. But we'll be back for the third episode next week, next Tuesday. Of course, the Fargo premiere comes out on 9 p.m. on Sunday. Hope to see you back then. Until then, oh, also, yeah, send all your feedback to fargo@baldmove.com. And until next week, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.